Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
We're in D.C. in front of the White House. Did you get an opportunity to watch the State of the Union last night?
No, I did not.
I was too sleepy.
I certainly did.
I thought overall President Biden did a great job addressing a lot of the issues at hand within the country and addressed a lot of the emotional turmoil that the American people are going through, while also really just vocalizing the response that he wants to have with the crisis going on in Ukraine.
And what do you think of Biden's first year?
I think he's doing the best he can under the circumstances. He inherited a lot of problems. He doesn't have a magic wand to correct everything overnight.
I think it has been an incredibly difficult position that he was put in when he was elected, and even that was in doubt by some. I, you know, pray for him all the time.
It kind of gave me a little more hope seeing the plans that are being set in place and the legislation that they're working on and that has been passed.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Joe Biden's presidency has been a hard thing for me to wrap my head around, honestly. Last spring, on this very show, we were talking about Biden's real transformational potential. We had a whole show where we entertained the idea that a new era was about to begin, one in which government was no longer a dirty word, and in which people had faith in the public sector to improve their lives. A bold new future. That's not how things have developed. On the contrary, it feels kind of like we've gone back in time. I mean, NATO's in conflict with Russia. There is anxiety about too much public spending. People are worried about crime and want more cops. And Biden's wartime bump aside, his poll numbers do suggest a meaningful number of people who were excited about his presidency have been disappointed so far. So what happened to Biden's transformational presidency? Can it all be chalked up to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema? I'm going to talk tonight to a political scientist who I suspect thinks everything that I just said reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of how presidents do and do not shape our politics. Corey Robin is a professor at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Last spring, back when I was fantasizing about a new era of love for big government, he was warning that Biden was unlikely to be a transformational figure. He also spent much of the Trump years arguing that liberals and conservatives alike have been exaggerating Trump's power and impact as well. So, Corey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here tonight.
And listeners, we can take your calls as we talk. I am particularly interested in hearing from people who were excited about Biden's presidency. If you were among the people dancing in the streets about it, how do you feel now? So, Corey, let's start with the big picture on transformational presidencies and how we should and should not think about them. You have written way back in December, I believe, you wrote in the New York Times, you argued that no president since Ronald Reagan has had a more productive first year than Joe Biden. And yet you also wrote, nonetheless, quote, "There's a sense of stuckness that no amount of social spending or policy innovation can seem to dislodge. The question is why." You say Biden is a prisoner of impossible expectations, and it's got something to do with presidential regimes, not presidential terms. So let's start there. Explain that.
Yeah, I think we tend to think of presidents, you know, with little more than 2 years hindsight or 2 years foresight. And the truth of the matter is that presidents operate in the context of these presidential regimes. FDR inaugurated the New Deal regime that lasted until 1980. And what the characteristic of a regime is that no matter who occupies the White House, Republican or Democrat, they have to speak within the constraints of a broad shared language. So Dwight David Eisenhower, when he was elected in 1952, many people hoped, oh, he's going to roll back the New Deal. And he didn't. In fact, he extended the New Deal. Ronald Reagan was the last transformational leader who inaugurated a new regime. And since 1980, we've been living in the shadow of that. If you remember, you know, Bill Clinton declared the era of big government over. Barack Obama came into office with, there was a lot of high expectations of transformation, and very quickly discovered that the rules of Reaganism were still in play. Joe Biden is pretty much in a somewhat similar situation. I think we had hoped, many people, that it would be different, but as we've seen things play out, we could talk more about why and how, the rules of Reaganism have not been overturned yet. Yeah. And that's what we're living with.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the why and how. I mean, not just Biden, but in general, what if we can map our history through these regimes, and I think in that piece you list like five of them. So there's not a lot, right? Going back to Thomas Jefferson. What actually shifts a regime? What are the conditions that allow that kind of change?
Two things. One is the regime itself is very, very weak and sclerotic. So think of Herbert Hoover's presidency or Jimmy Carter's presidency. Those are two good examples. Hoover was part of this extended Gilded Age regime. Jimmy Carter was part of this extended New Deal regime. Both of these presidents were governing at a moment where the rules were really in free fall and collapse. And you could see it in what they were doing. So Jimmy Carter was a Democrat, but he appointed Paul Volcker to the Fed, who was a very tight money, kind of Republican-ish leader of the Fed. Jimmy Carter expanded military spending. All of these things suggested that the New Deal order was coming undone. So that's one half of it that you need in order for a regime to be toppled. The other half is you need a president who is elected fundamentally committed, not just rhetorically, but politically and institutionally to the gutting of that regime. So Ronald Reagan, again, the one in most recent memory, Ronald Reagan had gone through 20 years of a long march within the Republican Party to transform it into an anti, you know, a really fundamentally anti-New Deal policy. It wasn't going to compromise with the New Deal. It was going to shatter it. Likewise, Franklin Delano Roosevelt committed to shattering the Gilded Age order. Abraham Lincoln fundamentally committed to shattering the slaveocracy. People oftentimes think that was just a product of the Civil War. It wasn't. The Republican Party was an abolitionist party. So these, you have to have these two factors, right? You need a regime that's very vulnerable, and you need a presidency and a party behind him or her that is committing to shattering that order. Go ahead.
Well, why don't you think it's putting Biden in that context? You know, I think a lot of people felt like felt like at least that first pillar that you're talking about was in existence, that it felt like a regime was shattering when we looked at Republican politics in general and the sort of ideas of Reaganism. And they didn't even have purchase in the Republican Party anymore, it seemed like. And Joe Biden's rhetoric, at least at the beginning, was very much, I mean, he sounded like FDR. So what is it that those of us who thought there was a shift coming didn't see that you saw?
Right. So I think you are absolutely right about the fragility of the Republican order. And you've given some very good examples. I mean, Trump in many ways was very similar to Jimmy Carter in that he was scrambling the rules within his own party of what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable. Remember his big stimulus package that the Republicans under his leadership passed with those extensive unemployment benefits. It was very transformative in its way. So you're absolutely right about that first half. I think the problem is with the second half. And the fact of the matter is that Joe Biden, there was a very bitterly fought out primary, and the Democratic Party, I don't want to say it was the Democratic Party elites, but the Democratic Party made a decision, a fundamental decision, that they wanted to go with the candidate who was more reassuring, who promised that really nothing fundamental will change. That was the nature of that political battle. Now, I know when after the election and with January 6th and the pandemic, there was a feeling like, well, wait a minute, you know, everything, the rules are really up for grabs now. But the fact of the matter is, political parties, in order to become transformative parties, they have to undergo something like what happened with the nomination of Ronald Reagan in 1980 or FDR. There just has to be a much more fundamental clash where the transformative part of the party comes out victorious. And that just did not, in the end, happen. The party made a firm decision. It did not want to go that route. And that's where we are. Now, I don't want to exaggerate this too much, because the truth is of the matter is, as you said, there are two Democratic senators who have kind of held some things up that might have pushed things. But in a way, I think that more illustrates the point that, you know, just two people, you know, under an FDR type of regime change order or Reagan, two people can't hold things up. Mm. They get swooshed away in the landslide.
By the force of history that's coming.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's very, very hard to have that kind of resistance. So I think, in a way, this is why people are so frustrated, because on the one hand, it seems so within our grasp. It's almost there. And then you have what feels like these two, you know, the prince, I always think of the Princess and the Pea story, these two pea pods, you know, stopping everything. And why can't they get swept away? Because, well, the party is not quite there yet. I think it could be, but it's just not there yet.
What do you think of the State of the Union? I mean, this for me was sort of the example. He went from sounding, Joe Biden went from sounding like FDR to sounding like Bill Clinton. Yeah. He didn't even mention, one of our producers pointed out today, one of the most popular ideas in Democratic Party liberal politics, like student debt relief, didn't even come up.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to prod you to think about what you heard there. Was that sort of for you like, okay, well, this is exactly what I said a year ago. This is, believe this man when he speaks, or did you hear anything new?
Well, both, actually. The part that was the continuous part, as you said, I thought that your Bill Clinton reference was right on point. You know, remember in the second half of this speech, it was just this sort of river of proposals and policy positions, one of which was, you know, we're going to get social media advertisers out of our kids' lives and so forth. And it reminded me of Bill Clinton's 1996 State of the Union address, where, you know, the big thing he was calling for was school uniforms. Right. And that is, just, you know, and it's exactly the same kind of a thing. You know, you focus on the kids, the little things, because your big economic package can't make it, you know, all the way through. I was also struck by in the Ukraine part of the speech. I mean, I don't know how anybody could have heard that and not thought to themselves, wait a minute, are you describing Russia under Putin? Are you describing the United States and its lack of democracy and its oligarchy? And the contrast between those two things, the fact that, you know, he said, you know, democracy is coming, you know, to Russia and Ukraine. Meanwhile, voting rights got, you know, just the barest blip of a mention in the State of the Union speech. And in my Times piece from December, I'd said, you know, without voting rights, you're not going to have a transformational presidency. And that's not just for moral reasons. Voting rights are the key to kind of to lock in institutionally the party's achievements within a transformational presidency. And when you don't have that kind of institutional locking in, you don't have a long-term transformation. It's just not possible. And the fact that voting rights was just like in the rear view window, here today, gone tomorrow, I think indicates where the party is at.
Let's go to James in Toms River, New Jersey. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So great coverage. But yeah, I think that presidents in general get like an outsized amount of responsibility put on them. So, I mean, they can only do so much within the framework. I mean, our government acts slow. That's what it is. It's almost by design. And like, I wasn't a Biden supporter. I wanted to return to normalcy, though. And I think that he's kind of trying to do that as best as possible. But at the end of the day, if people aren't with him, there's only so much he could do. Yeah. He's got to work in within the framework of how our government works. And yeah, if two senators want to be sticks in the mud, then that's the way that it is.
Can I ask, what did a return to normalcy mean to you when you say that? What did that mean to you?
Like the whole getting away from just the insanity that was Donald Trump. I mean, to be honest with you, I lean a little bit more libertarian, but in like a real sense of the word. I mean, Trump wanted big government, just his kind, and that's not what I wanted. And it was just crazy back then. And you know, I want a boring president that's more focused on policies and getting things done than, you know, tweeting.
Thank you for that, James. a boring president and limits to what a president can achieve. I guess I want to put that together, what James had to say, together with my broader question, Corey, for you about, well, so you wrote another piece in the New Yorker early in Biden's presidency, where, again, you predicted that this return to normalcy would not be transformational, and in which you said Trump also had not been transformational. And setting aside sort of the details of Trump for a moment, you said, quote, Biden's presidency would mark 12 years of an era in which the call of the voters is answered by the palsy of our institutions. So maybe I'm glomming something onto James he wasn't saying, but unpack for me what you mean by that, the palsy of our institutions that stand, that presumably get in the way of the kind of presidential power that some of us want, but that you and James think is presidents aren't going to have.
I think there's a couple of key institutions that are getting in the way. The first and foremost is the United States Senate. It's the one of the most anti-democratic, counter-majoritarian legislative institutions in the world. And it's the place where transformational politics goes to die. It always has been from the very get-go. I'm not even talking about the filibuster at all. And when I say all that, if you look at the statistics, 50 Democratic senators represent something like 40 million more voters than the Republican senators do. The Republican constituents tends to be white, tend to be rural, tend to be older. And that institution blocks transformational change. Barack Obama had to deal with this starting after the 2010 midterm. And interestingly, Donald Trump had to deal with it as well. We can get into the specifics of that or not. But the point being is that these three presidencies, very different in their personality, very different in their politics and in their character and their temperament, yet you see the same pattern over and over and over again where, the kind of big transformational politics get stopped. That's the Senate. The other is, of course, the United States Supreme Court. We haven't even dealt with, let's assume Biden could get through his some of his packages through Congress and sign them. You have now a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court that is dead set on much of these kinds of transformational politics. This is the position that the Supreme Court has historically occupied in our polity. Striking down legislation that has the support of the majority over and over and over again. And that is another part of what, assume, like I said, that Biden had gotten that program through. We have no idea what the Supreme Court would do. Yeah. And it certainly tried to stop FDR as well.
I'm talking with political scientist Corey Robin about when presidencies can and cannot be transformative. After the break, we'll talk about what he says we've all gotten wrong about Donald Trump's power in some detail, and we'll take more of your calls. Were you initially excited about Biden's presidency? If you were among the people dancing in the streets when he won the 2020 election, how do you feel now? We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. Last week, you heard Kai talk to Brian Lehrer about the state of our public discourse. We asked you, what entices you to engage in difficult conversations about touchy subjects? Here's one voicemail we got from a listener named Leora.
I have grown into being less afraid to be my full self. And being my full self is a proud fat Black woman who is outspoken and who is shy and who is funny and who is loud and sometimes inappropriate, like embracing all of these things. So I have to have these conversations to answer your question because I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice in the spaces I move. I mean, I think if you are anyone who is physically othered, your choice to just be apolitical or to just be quiet, I don't think you really have that choice. We aren't afforded that privilege because our whole humanity is at stake. That's me. Thanks for listening.
We are listening. And when we say we want to hear from you, we really mean it. So thanks, Leora. If you've got something to share, send us a message. Record yourself on your phone and email us. The address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. And thanks.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
It is delivered in person to a joint session. President brings his proposals before the elected representatives of the people.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Vice President.
Distinguished members of the House and Senate.
Distinguished guests.
My fellow Americans.
Fellow citizens.
My fellow Americans.
On this hill, which was my home.
It is my task to report the State of the Union.
Tonight I have the honor of reporting to you on the State of the Union.
To improve it is the task of us all.
Thank you all.
And may God bless the United States of America.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. Okay, so Corey, before the break, I alluded to your longstanding argument that liberals and conservatives alike have overstated Trump's power even as president, let alone now. You've argued that the strongman caricature we've assigned him is mistaken. And in fact, you've argued that today's right wing is not at all comparable to a fascist takeover, as many have said, but rather, and I'll quote, an artifact of the world's most ancient and extant legal order holding on to the Constitution and the institutions it authorizes for dear life. So explain yourself here, Corey.
So there's two elements of this that I would talk about. One is if we just actually look at the record of Donald Trump and compare it to presidents like George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon, the fact of the matter is he was extraordinarily constrained in what he tried to do and was very unsuccessful in getting it done. Even on something like immigration, which rightly got so much attention because of the sort of cruelty that we saw at the border. The truth of the matter is that Trump was never able to get an immigration bill through to restrict immigration through Congress, even when the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. We forget that those first 2 years, they had total control over all those federal institutions, and they weren't able to get an immigration bill through. He couldn't even get funding for his wall from a Republican Congress, which led to huge fights between him and Paul Ryan. Of course, there is the famous debacle of Obamacare. They weren't able to overthrow that. And if you look even more closely at his budgets, and this, you know, drove a lot of very conservative Republicans crazy, the budgets were pretty much Barack Obama budgets in terms of spending on things like Planned Parenthood, things like the National Endowment for the Arts, all those culture war things that you would think they would have gone after. They never did, and when they tried to, they were unsuccessful. So there's so much in the record that I think, again, has been eclipsed because he was such an odious and sort of hard, disgusting man, in terms of on social media, but that we didn't really see the way the policies went down. The second part of what you're asking about just quickly is that the fascist comparison is oftentimes meant to mean that, you know, he appeals to this kind of popular white working class base, and that's where he gets his power from. And I think that really gets the whole story backwards. That was true of presidents like Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, who really not only did that red meat kind of politics, it worked for them. They had huge electoral majorities. Trump, on the other hand, you know, never once got an electoral majority, a popular majority. What put him into power and kept the Republicans in power were three things. The Electoral College, which is by no means a fascist institution. We should get rid of it.
I guess
we
should depends get rid on who you ask, but no, not by the definition.
Yeah, we should get rid of it, but, you know, that's not what it's about. So it's the Electoral College, the Supreme Court. And as again, as I said, the United States Senate, these have been the pillars of Republican power, and they will continue to be in the future. Those are all artifacts of our Constitution. The Republican Party could not exist as it does and wield any power without those institutional mechanisms. And I would also add federalism, which is, which gives so much power to states. So I think the way we think about this problem is sort of have it a little bit backwards and don't see where the real danger lies and focus more on other things.
Well, but I mean, so then the growing concern amongst many people, myself included, with the notion of minority rule, I guess your core argument yes. here is that that's actually how it's built. And there it is.
Yes. I think minority rule is an absolutely, that is the right way. And this is from the very get-go, is what I was warning about with Trump, that, I was focused initially on the Supreme Court. And then, lo and behold, you start seeing how it bleeds out into all these other areas. But minority rule is the problem. And the Constitution enables it. We've had how many now? We've had two presidents in this century elected without winning the popular vote, where the other candidate won more votes. We hadn't had that throughout the 20th century. It had happened in the 19th century a few times. We're reverting back to an older kind of style of rule that I think people had hoped we had overcome. And again, here's where the Constitution becomes such an enabler. And it's something that I think liberals I think they've gotten better about the conversation on that order, but they tend to dance around that because I think we associate the Constitution with things like free speech, freedom of association,
the 14th rights, Amendment, the 15th
14th Amendment, the civil rights, voting rights. Those are all part of the Constitution, but there's a lot of else that goes into the Constitution.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Jim in South Orange. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. Go ahead.
So if I could piggyback on what you guys were just discussing, there's no question that Trump never became the fascist that he craved to be. But that doesn't mean that he didn't want to be one. there's no question that he was white privilege's last stand, or hopefully he was, but he wanted to be, a fascist, and everything he said and most of what he did was pointing in that direction. But I don't think that negates, the fact that he never got to be one doesn't negate everything, all the evidence. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so, I'll talk about what I called it.
but it's a useful point. Thank you for that, Jim. Is this a distinction without a difference? But what about Joe Biden? I take it, okay, were hopeful about Joe Biden when he was elected.
Of course, I was quite hopeful when Biden was elected. Hopeful that his last name did not begin with a T, and we might see some transformative policies, some redistributive economics, some more fairness in the way society was structured, some opportunity.
And how do you feel now?
Further down through society, I feel quite disappointed. I feel like I don't understand this dynamic of trying to work with people who have a knife in your back. And I see it throughout. It's like a culture of the Democratic Party. This Mr. Yeah. Nice Guy, Miss Nice Guy stuff, where, people have shown themselves, this party has shown themselves.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there just for time, but I get the message here that part of your disappointment is that maybe Joe Biden has not shown the kind of thing that Corey Robin is saying is one of the pillars of a transformational presidency, which is a willingness to just fight and tear down the last one. Let's go to Salvatore in Greenwich Village. Salvatore, welcome to the show.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Very well.
Good. So I'm someone who was in the streets jumping for joy when Biden got elected. And I was very hopeful, and I feel that Biden knows the broad-based constituency that got him elected, and he's tried to address all their issues. But I think he came against the forces of reaction in his country. So I think he takes a long-term view. In this case, the long-term view is the midterm election. So he has to win another significant legislative victory before the midterms. But the alternative to Biden is so horrible and reactionary that I think people got to be motivated to elect more senators, more congresspeople into office. And he would do our bidding. He would do the bidding of his broad-based coalition. I think he's doing the best he can. He's a smart guy. He's a mature guy. And, you know, I wish him the best, not the best.
Okay. Thank you, Salvador. Let's go to Kate in Washington Heights. Kate, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I wanted to say that I think Biden has kind of erased the white noise that Trump had around his presidency. So we're able to focus on the actual issues. And I also was very encouraged by the trading ban or the trading curb that is now, I think, on the Senate floor to put pressure on lawmakers to not trade stocks and to not benefit personally from information that they had. And I think that's in direct response to the corruption that exists under Trump.
Thank you, Kate. We have less than a minute left, Corey, but Mike, in as pointed as you can, what do I do with the point that you are making here?
Well, I mean, I think one of the callers brought this up is that there needs to be more power on the left, and it's not just going to come from within the party. It needs to be a social movement, and that's the way the Lincoln Republican regime came about. That's the way FDR's New Deal order came about. You had the marriage of a party willing to act with a social movement on the ground.
Corey Robin is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Sound design by Jared Paul. Matthew Mirando was at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, and Kusha Navadar. And I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright, or you can find me live every Sunday evening, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.